Hello, survivors, and welcome to A Moment of Relief, the first Ace Brace show where we talk about whatever the hell we want. We'll be talking about game adaptations today, and video adaptations, and movie adaptations, and TV adaptations, and just adaptations underlying from pixels to pitfalls and platforms. We're going to be trying to talk about everything in between, if we can. It's a tough subject. It's like a big subject to talk about.
Small and straightforward, James.
It's just a little. It doesn't make fans mad at every turn.
I mean, that at least is universal. Doesn't matter what you're a fan of, you are mad about it when it happens.
Yeah. There's something in the fandom, whichever you're talking about, you're going to be mad about something. And I do have like a first talking point. And that is kind of like what do we think makes an adaptation good? What do we think makes an adaptation like successful? And we'll talk about like the pitfalls later on, like the negatives, because I think they can be spoken about for a long time. What makes them good? Like faithful storytelling, casting, a little bit of everything. Obviously, that's a catch-all, but what do you think is most important about it, Steve?
Oh goodness me! You've already hit me with a bullet because some content's great and it can have changes throughout the adaptions. Some things are great because they follow it, right? The TV show of The Last of Us, for example, right? Mm. Pretty much, not quite, but 95% one-to-one with this game counterpart, yeah. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you've got Castlevania, which is basically more of a riffing on the original lore. To go throughout it, and that's fantastic. And then you've got something on the other end, like Captain N, which is just take all of Nintendo's properties and blend them into a horrible mess. It's an adaption of things, but not necessarily. And then Legend of Zelda, like, we can all meme on, excuse me,
it's me, princess.
But I don't think at one point in any of the games has Link ever said that, and we've been all gone, yeah, that's what I'm talking about. and then Cyberpunk. Cyberpunk Edgerunners, ancillary content that's more of an adaptation into the universe but is its own thing, then gets co-opted by the main content, the game, and it's reinstalled into it. It's a very layered topic. topic.
See, you bring up Cyberpunk as well. Like, Cyberpunk is a great subject, thing to bring up, because Cyberpunk started with books and then was made into and then that novels and board games then was made into a video game, and then we got the anime, and now we have even more board games to do with Cyberpunk as well. I realize it was a big subject.
It's just as enough forward. Like I'm saying, there are many different angles to approach. For me personally, it depends on what the medium it is. Like, for example, a live action TV show playing at doing a horror story. Yeah, I think the way The Last of Us did it works better than, say, Captain N.
what is Captain N?
Captain N, okay, right, in the early
Captain
90s.
Captain N was the games master. How could you not remember Captain? Well, no, you probably went around the time.
I don't know what it is.
Before Smash Brothers was even a thing, James, imagine an animated TV show set. A young boy gets basically sucked into his Nintendo on his TV, and he's in a world actually... fighting against a twisted version of Mother Brain from Metroid with the help of some variant of Mega Man, some variant of Pit from Kid Icarus, and Simon Belmont. Isn't like a Conan the Barbarian type. No, he's like a plucky adventurer Indiana Jones type. Come that giant duck pilot from DuckTales. Vastly different adaptation of all the characters. Zelda and Link do show up in it, but they are like the cartoon show variant of Zelda and Link.
Oh, they did it first. Kept saying it first.
Before Smash Brothers. But it was also terrible.
I mean, I agree. I remember watching it when I was a kid. It failed at the very first hurdle, because the idea was Captain N was the games master. He was this guy who was apparently the best video game player in the entire universe, and that's why he got chosen to go into Nintendo World, or wherever it was called, to basically go and save the world. However, the intro showed him struggling to defeat King Hippo on Punch-Out, which is one of the easiest fights in all of Punch-Out.
I remember playing Punch-Out.
I mean, like, so the games master, the guy who's the most incredible person ever, can't beat the most basic of enemies. Here we are.
Is it Eggplant Wizard? Is Mother Brain's sidekick?
Yep.
Oh, God.
From Kid Icarus.
Yeah. Oh, beautiful.
So, showing.
And then you forgot Game Boy suddenly became a thing. Do you remember that? So, at some point when they released the Game Boy, Boy became a character. In
Captain, I don't even remember this. It's completely, it's like,
see, gone through my brain. My lore is beyond even Steve.
Maybe it was so bad that my brain is like, I want to forget.
imagine like a Game Boy with like a sort of, you know, kind of an acid face on it in the screen, and then it flies around a bit like a magic carpet and sort of talks to people. And
I'm gonna have to look this up after.
Yep.
I'm gonna have to look this up after because that sounds intriguing, but at the same time, awful.
You'll enjoy Simon Belmont when you get there.
Oh, God.
It's very different. It's a very different take on Simon Belmont.
I think, to caveat it all, from depends on the source medium, James. If the game is light in tone, it opens the room up more for more narrative embellishment. That make any sense? Like the Sonic the Hedgehog cartoons, like I think there's like 40 million of them now, but there was originally like two. There was Adventures of the Sonic the Hedgehog, which was basically more stupid gag like SpongeBob before SpongeBob, and then you had Sirius, which was Satan. But you know, the event, Sonic basically fighting a rebel apocalypse Terminator squad held by a fat Robotnik, as opposed to when he was Slim Steven. But yeah, vast tone shifts from the actual game where it's just green dude jumps on, blue dude runs through things, jumps on stuff, smashes stuff.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so I put down. I like to call on kind of, you know, professional heads. At this week, the CEO of Larian, Sven Vinke, he said something quite poignant to this subject, which touched me, and I'll talk about it in the next subject as well. But like, he said that publishers, they focus a lot on doubling revenue year after year, and you know, it means that the original work of passion that was there, it's all jaded because of that. Margins are put on people, they're pushed, you know, and it doesn't have all the work it could have had. And he says in relation to BG3 that which is a brand new adaptation of Dungeons & Dragons 5th edition into a video game, he talks about how they spent their time with this game. He made sure that everyone working on it loved what they did. And were committed and loved everything that they did during it. And he like, judging by him up on the stage, he really knows how to read people. Like, I mean, as a CEO, I think you should be able to do that. Some people don't. But yeah. And then BG3 won Game of the Year in last year. You know, so like, BG3 was nothing like the original Baldur's Gate, which is also an adaptation of.
Mm.
So you got two adaptations there. Technically three, I guess, because you're talking about the world as well. You had some foundations there and voice acting that was similar, but like the world it was set in was even different as well. Like, it was augmented in some way, but it still won. Is it like you were saying earlier on Castlevania? It's very different, but you can see the passion that's there, and that's what caused its success in the end. You know, because you saw that the people loved the characters and they just put them into the modern world. And created what they could, and you could see all the work they put in there, and they were given like the creative freedom to make something beautiful. I think that, for me, that's what makes, no matter what it is, I think that's what makes an adaptation successful. And we don't always have, like, these companies, they don't always have that backing like Larian did. You know, you don't always have Wizards of the Coast behind the curtains going, here's the money, you know. And I understand that. It's just it's what Sven Vinke said really touched me, because I think we don't see enough of that. We see just talking heads, you know. Speaking of Netflix, for instance, when the Netflix Resident Evil came out, we're just seeing a lot of talking heads saying, I really like Resident Evil, you know, and they could have just like pressed their little doodads on there and teleported out of there. You know, they didn't care. I didn't feel like I ever felt like they cared about the franchise. But you can definitely see the passion in the folks behind Castlevania, Baldur's Gate 3, Edge Runners. You know, you can see the passion there. I think that's important.
I think I can probably provide a bit of connective tissue here, because this is definitely not my first rodeo of this. I think, and I'll shorten down the spiel, because I've only said this about 1,000 times. The most important thing to consider whenever you make an adaptation of anything is you have to look at what is the core DNA of what that property is. And I'll use Resident Evil as the obvious example, right? So what's the core DNA of Resident Evil? Well, it's resource management, it's suspense, it's terror. Is it shooting every zombie you can see? No. But that's a big misconception. It's drilling into what makes Resident Evil feel like, you know, playing a Resident Evil game feel like a Resident Evil game.
Mm.
And you can very quickly start to look at, you know, you can, yeah, if you were to sit down and write down on a whiteboard, a piece of paper, or whatever you want to do, you can very quickly start to identify the unifying factors of what makes a game feel, or, you know, whatever the IP is, to be fair, but what makes it what it is compared to its rivals or other things in the marketplace. And at that point, when you come to an adaptation, those are your key beats you have to consider. Not always necessarily hit them. You don't always necessarily need to go, well, Resident Evil's about resource management, so yeah, we're going to make a Resident Evil animated movie where it's basically everyone running around opening menus all the time and counting their bullets. Like, you know, you don't want to do that. But there's ways of you can still foster that sense of, yeah, where are we going to find our next ammunition? Like, yeah, the characters can talk about how they're low on ammo. You know, talk about kind of, I don't want to waste bullets on this thing. Oh, we can't afford to keep, you know, to keep killing everything we see, whatever else. And the more that you layer in stuff like that, the more it starts to feel closer and closer to what the actual, yeah, to what the actual license or property or whatever you want to call it is. And I think that's something where a lot of things go horribly wrong, because you can do that. And if you hit those key beats and if it feels like it's got the same energy and the same spirit as whatever the source material was, then it will feel like it's a faithful adaptation, because fans who liked it will like the same things as what they liked in the original game or property. Yeah, again, film, whatever it is. The moment you start to deviate from that, yeah, there are small steps and then there are much bigger steps. As soon as you start making bigger steps away, people sit down and watch it and go, this didn't feel like that thing that I love. Mm-hmm. And that's the point where I think you start to trip over and you start to not quite get it right. Yeah, you can, and we'll go back, and once again, I'll go back to Resident Evil. You can make a Resident Evil movie, let's say, that dramatically deviates from what we know as the Resident Evil story in canon. You really can. I mean, they do it quite a bit, apparently. So the point is that you can dramatically go away from that as long as the spirit of what Resident Evil is shines through. And at that point, people will talk about it and go, Joe, that felt like a Resident Evil movie. It was an original story, but it doesn't matter about that. Like, it felt like I was playing a Resident Evil game, or the similarities in terms of the way the setup was and the development of the plot arc and kind of, you know, the way it all came out in the end, that sort of stuff. As long as it feels that way, great. And that can be just as faithful as having something which literally is a one-for-one retelling of the Spencer Mansion, for example.
Yeah.
And I think that's something where, if you think back to, you know, those adaptations where you've watched them or seen them or read them or played them or whatever, where they feel horrendously wrong, that's the point where it just starts to feel really weird. The example I'll give is a long, long while ago, I remember playing a Batman game, which I think was on, I'm going to say the Amiga. It was a very old, old back in the day. Okay. So it came out basically after the first Batman movie. It was a adaptation into a video game. And one of the moves Batman could do is pull out a gun and shoot someone. And at that point, it falls down because the whole point of the Batman character is that he doesn't like people with guns. Like, you know, his whole family's being, or his parents have been killed by kind of, you know, by a gunman. Like, so the fact that Batman could just casually pull out a Glock and then just end someone doesn't really work. But I'm sure in a video game perspective it did, but that's a step away from the source material, and that straight away was a cognitive dissonance moment where it just sort of disconnect and went, "Ooh, that's weird."
Mm.
And one of those, maybe that kind of fits. Two of those, okay, now I'm not sure what this is, but it's definitely not the thing that I love. Three of these things, and now I'm kind of, as a fan, saying, yeah, I don't care about this product anymore. And I think that's the key things to sort of bear in mind.
Yeah, the feel.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I think that's so hard for, and that might be so hard for companies to, or creative teams to grasp, is the feel of something. Like, it's if you don't know the source material.
Do you think that might be it?
Definitely like, that.
Creative, like, love for the topic that you're adapting is obviously paramount, because the amount of times we've heard of, like, this was going to be this, but it was retooled into being this. Like, those kind of properties tend to always feel a little bit hollow and upset people. Super Mario Brothers movie, not the new one that everyone's loved, that's all, like, you know, based in the games. I'm talking about the original 90s one.
The scary one.
That could have been any cyberpunk sci-fi thing before then you embellish it with Mario stuff on top. You know, it's...
Yeah.
You know, I'm not saying... You know, I'm one of those weirdos that actually enjoys that film for as a sci-fi cyberpunk film anyway, mainly because Bob Hoskins is hilarious. But that's an outlier. For example, the recent Onimusha on Netflix, CGI animated thing, there is literally no real through line. You get like a few member berry style things in terms of they have an Oni gauntlet. It does things that you can fight demons with. Could be any sci-fi, fantasy samurai versus demon story. It really is a cutaway. It has references to real life events and people, but not so much anything from the games, but like, hey, it's this gauntlet. Do you recognize this gauntlet? I used to kill monsters. And the other side of the spectrum, Cyberpunk 2077, Edgerunners. Literally set in the same city, set during around the same time frame of the actual game itself. Mm. Lots and lots of stuff you can see there. I think there's a few character reprisals from the game. I haven't played enough of 2077 to really know, but I know that you can get calls from one in the other. So
yeah.
It's surprising how much love and attention went into that I've seen in like screenshots. I'm going to be honest, I haven't finished 2077. Okay, don't hate. But I know there are things throughout.
As everybody knows, we are a Cyberpunk 2077 podcast.
Okay, here's another one for me. James, you know more about Arcane and where it's from. How much of that is reflected in universe? Is that a good adaptation, or is it just a fun adaptation in the same universe?
In the video game?
Hmm.
The only things you're told are being given a world map and lore passages on the characters. Like... And they've essentially built and voice lines from the characters. They've essentially just built that entire series from those passages. Like there are no League of Legends. League of Legends. Like
there's no legends of monsters and people getting shot over the internet in the show.
They just brought like extremely good writers in that characterized those characters very well.
Mm.
Like if so Vi, for instance, she's very rambunctious. She likes to kick the crap out of things. If someone like makes her go too far, like she will get her fists out. But she's also incredibly loyal and fierce with that loyalty. You have Jinx, who's absolute crackpot, but she used to be like a good person, right? So they've taken those elements and they've created a story out of it, you know, and while keeping it, because I think the biggest thing about League is the world that it's built in.
Not so much the game itself, the lore and the world.
Yeah, like everybody wants, when Arcane came out, and even with the MMO that's being made in the next few years, everybody wants to be in the world. They want to be there, you know, and... Yeah, Arcane gave you that. You felt immersed. You felt in the moment. You felt for these characters, because there's weight there with the characters, like as well.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think there's a couple of points that I think is worth raising at this stage. Again, it's possibly connected tissue stuff. The first one is I think a lot of adaptations fall down a trap of simulationism. And maybe we'll come to that later on when we talk about the pitfalls.
We can go into it now if you want.
Now. Oh, no, it's okay. We could circle back around to that. But I think that's something where that trips people up. And then I think the second one, and this definitely alludes to the point you guys are talking about, which is you can really tell when you're playing something or watching something or whatever the medium is, and the people who create it, you can tell rather than being true fans, they watched some YouTube videos or whatever the thing was, and then went and made it because they kind of went, again, it's like It's like you know, talking to someone who's a Resident Evil fan who will immediately then begin to tell you their six or seven favourite like camera angles in the original games or whatever else, or where you could find every item, or here's some obscure lore from the 90s that you may or may not know, right? Versus someone who says, I like Resident Evil because I'm Marines and I shoot things.
And
you're like, yeah, that's it. Like, yeah, someone who can talk to you about the difference between the original trilogy and then what happened to them later on and so on. And I think it's always... that stuff always comes through. That definitely sort of almost ties a bow in what you were talking about earlier in terms of people saying about passion projects and everything else. You could tell when something's a passion project for people. Or they're invested in a way because they clearly love the source IP and they want it to be something where it resonates through what they do. Mm-hmm. And it feels just like that. Even if, again, things deviate and change around a bit, you can still get that sense. Whereas... there's other times when someone has clearly just stuck a label on top of something. It's Monopoly syndrome, and it's that kind of thing. So
yeah, Aliens Colonial Marines.
Oh goodness!
Well, they mentioned Monopoly, everything.
that is a game that no one knew how to make an alien game. Like, they didn't know how to make an alien game. They literally just looked at a wiki with that one. Yeah, that makes complete sense. Steve?
Well, I keep circling. I think we're hitting the nail a bit on the head. Like, for example, right, I haven't watched all of
I think we need to hit it hard, right? Because...
Okay.
Well, we all take a turn to tap the nail, so it's your turn,
Steve. Going back to the topic of adaptions that are really well done, right, The Last of Us, right, that had direct contact and involvement with the game's dev team. You know, I think that's almost paramount, generally speaking. From what I understand, the Halo show, very divisive at the moment. It's doing its own thing with the lore and is separated mostly from the actual creative team of the games to the point where it's frustrating people on the internet, and they're doing a statement which is just going to upset people, which is just, we're not going to make it for fans of the game. Then who are you making it for?
Right.
You know, not to be volatile for a second, but the amount of times I've seen a game adaption in some way, shape or form going, we're not making it for the fans of the games. Okay, cool. You've lost a chunk of your potential audience straight away. Now, it's all well and good you're trying to get another audience. You should probably still want to keep the existing one on side. I'm not saying make everything one-to-one. We've already established there are many things that don't go one-to-one and are perfectly fine. But when you are trying to upset and incendiate, basically throw a petrol bomb at the existing fans who are going to turn up anyway, it's never a good sign.
No, it's... That is a wild thing to...
Sorry, go on, Steve.
No, you're fine.
No, go ahead,
Dan. Sure. I think there's also there's a couple of unique examples in that as well, which come to mind. And this will be a hotly contested one. So there we are.
Let's go.
What was the new Amazon Lord of the Rings adaptation?
Rings of Power.
Yeah.
There you go. So Rings of Power was really interesting for me because scroll back to the 90s, right? Only geeks have ever even been aware of the existence of Lord of the Rings. Like, only like the bullied kid and like the one who sat in the library instead of going out and playing football or whatever else has ever really read this thing and knows anything about it. That's pretty much exactly what it is. Pre-movies essentially was what I'm saying. Skip forward to the movies coming out, and suddenly now it's gone mainstream. Everyone knows what Lord of the Rings is. It's a massive thing, and everyone has their own ideas about it. But what I think is really interesting is the Lord of the Rings movies are not the Lord of the Rings that you see in the book.
No.
And I think Rings of Power, by comparison, was the Lord of the Rings you see in the book, or at least much closer to it. Now, all of the fallout that came around when that show came out, talking about how this didn't feel like Lord of the Rings, and, they changed all these other bits and pieces in it, and, it just wasn't the same thing as what they were looking for. I came from people who... basically, their estimation of Lord of the Rings was those movies.
Mm.
And there's a point where you have to realize there's an audience, but the audience that you had to appeal to, which one are you going to shoot for? As you say, Steve, are you going to go for the fans of the TV, of the movie series? In which case, you've got to go for one direction, or are you going to go for Lord of the Rings book fans? In which case, you're going in a different direction. Because those two things, the Venn diagram the Venn diagram where those two two things meet isn't immediately obvious in many ways.
Hmm.
A lot of it is sort of a token nod of, it's definitely got Legolas in it, for example. That sort of stuff. It doesn't necessarily cross over. And that's, I think, where where that series particularly fell flat. There were some funky things they did with it as well. But the point is that I think it, the spirit was right for one thing, but not what the majority wanted. And I think that's always, that's another, yeah, it's a good, very acute pitfall of what these things can be, but worth mentioning now because of what you just raised.
Well, I just, it's seeing things online these days, especially with discourse about anything, there's always going to be someone with an opinion about anything. You know, and you have to be very careful with the words that you say. At least that's the way it feels these days. You could literally just swap a small trailer of something and it looks nothing like the games and say, yeah, but it is. We're making it because it is. And then it's revealed to not be, for example. And then, it turns out we weren't aiming for the, you know, we were doing our own thing anyway. And I'm rambling a bit. Sorry, I apologize. It's just...
No, you're right.
Intent.
I mean, that's what this show's about.
Intent. If the intent is not... I'm trying to not say just be a fan service vehicle, because a lot of these projects aren't. Like The Witcher, for example, that's more adaption of the book than it is the game, even though it looks more game-like than it does anything like in the imagery established from the books. Mm. And that's a passion project. And it was fine. Most people liked it, right? I again, cursory knowledge, never played the games, only read a bit of the early novels. Yeah. Perfectly fine, on board with that. But then someone does the Resident Evil TV show, the Resident Evil movies, where there's cursory knowledge at best. They've taken bits and pieces of the lore and cherry-picked it fine to make their own story. This could have been any other science fiction story, and it's been reinterpreted as a Resident Evil story. And now we're getting to the point where, I mean, we're a bit past it, but movie stuff gets bleeding back into the games, becomes its own Ouroboros of references that were never intended, that are now part of, diluting the whole thing. Mm. Frustrates me a little bit. It
comes from, I think Resident Evil is also, like, just speaking of Resident Evil here, because I could go into other stuff, but just with Resident Evil, the everything is so diluted within the franchise, like when it comes to canon and the stories and the characters and where they are, where they're going, who they are. Like, there are so many different universes to pull from. Everyone has, you know, I think that's why it's such a hotly contested subject with Resident Evil and adaptations and stuff, because everyone has their own kind of their own idea of what Resident Evil is, and it's because there are so many different types of Resident Evil.
Mm.
You know, so there's some people who only stand the CGI movies, you know, for instance. There are some people who only stand three games or another three games, you know, and they don't care about all the rest.
Mm.
You know, and that's because it's a bit muddled. Like, and I put that onus on Capcom a little bit.
Mm. I mean, yeah, sometimes they can succeed despite this. Like Street Fighter.
Yeah.
For example, Street Fighter's had, I believe, two, maybe three animated adaptions. One was basically G.I. Joe with Street Fighter characters, and one was a slightly slow-paced anime using the established characters. Surprisingly, guess which one's more fondly remembered? The one that's basically nothing related to the games.
Mm. Yeah.
So...
I definitely think with regards to Resident Evil, Capcom haven't, I choose my words carefully here, but I think they haven't necessarily been really good custodians at all times of their lore and or protective enough of what it is. I think exactly as you say, like, Resident Evil has long since become something where it has its own universes and its own things. And some of that, to be fair, is the relentless drive for fans to establish a sense of universe. Yeah, a sense of universe, or something can't be a standalone product of what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you go back to when, the original Resident Evil was released, and then stuff we saw afterwards, like Gaiden and Survivor and other stuff like that, the sense was just, this is a Resident Evil game. Doesn't need to have kind of where it fits into the grand scheme of things. Doesn't need to have a connection. Think of the Final Fantasy series. Like, they don't have to, with exception of a couple of them that have been actually made as sequels or whatever else, it's just a Final Fantasy game. No, people could endlessly argue about, is there a connection between Final Fantasy VII and VIII, for example, because they have a similar couple of crossover things, or because Sid always rocks up at some point. Like, the point is that you don't necessarily need to go to that point. You can just say this was a thing that was a Resident Evil product. Yeah, whatever it may be. Mm. But, yeah, it's an interesting one, isn't it?
Yeah. I think we touched on it a little bit, but we could go into pitfalls here and there, like what things that could be avoided, whether it be Resident Evil or other things. Yes, I'm going to talk about BG3 again, but...
I'll dive in on the first one I had and then leave the floor open to you guys, which is basically simulationism is the biggest pitfall. And that is where this sense of, if you want to recreate this thing, you have to do it exactly as it was in the original, or otherwise it doesn't really count somewhere. And again, we go back to, let's go to the first Resident Evil movie. That should have been, I'll be the first to admit, when I was a thousand years ago when I was young and it first came out, like when that was released, well, why didn't they just tell the original story of the first game? Because it's a great story, and why didn't they do that? And yeah, Resident Evil fans would still love it. And that's not necessarily not a valid perspective, rather than the mess that we actually got. But the point is that it doesn't need to have been that. What I really was expressing at the time when I kind of got very angry, in that sort of way that, young Sherwin could do about these sorts of things, being very passionate, was basically that a bad movie came out, is really what I was concerned about, if you want to strip it back.
Yeah.
And the confusion wasn't, well, it must have followed the existing Resident Evil stuff because it's a Resident Evil thing. It was more so much, how could they have not told the original story if they were going to do anything instead of this mess that they actually created? And I think that's a key thing. Like, you can create the same feel, the same ideas, the same concept, similarity for people without necessarily having to do everything exactly the same way. You can still create a sense of suspense or tension or fear and now we'll open it up to every other IP in there, fun, entertainment, whatever it is that's unique about that IP, you can still make it feel that way without necessarily doing exactly the same things as what one medium did, because some things just simply don't cross over. Mm-hmm. Yeah, think about books and movies and everything else. If I look at the Battle Royale movie versus the Battle Royale manga versus the Battle Royale novel, all of those tell the same story. They all have exactly the same feel as each other, but they achieve it in very different ways. The book is very dystopian. The movie is it's just almost like kind of that sort of crazy over the edge kind of gore fest for the fun of it kind of thing. And then the anime the manga by comparison is actually all about camaraderie. And it literally is like a thing where you're really sad when some of the kids die, because it actually takes a bit more time to sort of develop the relationships between them, and it actually has much more meaning to it.
Mm-hmm.
Which isn't necessarily make it better than the other mediums. It should be stressed. Like, there's something for the abruptness of the movie, for example, and just how sort of cold and inhumane it is oftentimes. But it certainly gives it that extra sort of feel to... Yeah, it does. It achieves what its goals are in a different way. And that's all because the mediums are just so far different. You couldn't take the time the manga did in a movie to explain it. It's a TV series at that point, if that's what you're doing.
Yeah.
And why isn't there a Battle Royale TV series, as a side note? Yeah, the novel, by comparison, obviously came along first and suffers a little bit here from basically not necessarily having... seeing what the other mediums did with it, but also is much more cerebral, and you understand the character, the protagonist a lot more, because a lot of it is inside his head and it's him thinking about, okay, what's happening now? How do I feel about this? In a way that you simply don't get in the other two. So,
yeah.
Anyway, over to you guys.
Yeah, no, you're completely right. Well said, Steve.
Well, I was just. Showing mentioning how there was three different variations of it also, and that's like the spark to head about adaptions of things that were never. I've been mostly talking about like TV shows and things, haven't I? And one of my favorite games is an adaptation of a book that literally almost is a pseudo sequel or not even in any way embellished or related to. Like say through a few throwaway lines of dialogue. Well, maybe not throwaway, but throwaway lines of dialogue, and that's Parasite Eve. Like the game. Allegedly is set in the same universe, but there's no casting of fireballs, no giant monster things that you blast to pieces, certainly no building guns and finding the ultimate life form and killing it on a boat and surviving nuclear blasts. The novels are basically dude finds his wife's cells, tries to cultivate a clone of his wife. Turns out that thing's possessed by bullshit cells that wants to create their own ultimate creature. They hug and they die. It's a very different adaptation from shooting monsters in a survival horror environment, I think you'll agree. So I guess what I'm really saying is it's all nonsense. I feel almost underqualified at the sheer breadth of this subject. There's always going to be something that turns around that I go, yeah, I hate this, but this thing did this, and I was totally fine with it.
Like, all right. If you want, I've got one I can throw at you, which you'll have no problem talking about this for a whole bunch of time. Okay? There are some times when you get an adaptation which comes out and it exceeds the original.
Mm.
And it actually blasts it into oblivion. And for that, you need to look no further than the Transformers the movie in 1986. Because that took a cartoon which was ultimately, you know, obviously it captivated millions of people, but went on a whole new level and went so much harder than everything it needed to do. And yeah, I mean, like, The Transformers movie from back then is a horror movie.
Yeah,
it's not.
Yeah,
it's not the TV show. It's not lighthearted. Like, right from the point where you start seeing your heroes just gunned down mercilessly to the point where, yeah, you have a planet that's just devouring everything, I think, is the exact quote. Devouring everything in its path. It's a horror movie, and all the way through to the soundtrack and everything else. And yeah, I think sometimes, yeah, and that obviously is an adaptation of sorts, even though it's an easier one to go from TV to a movie, I suspect. But it is something where sometimes they just go head and shoulders above, and it really redefines what the actual IP is. And I think that's a really good example of that. Steve, you definitely have an opinion about this.
Well, I mean, you know, going from a Saturday morning cartoon show where the good robots and the bad robots fight over purple cubes to basically Star Wars with a bit of Lovecraft robot and all of your beloved robots die and now here's a new cast of fresh faced characters. Bit of a tonal shift. Seeing characters that would normally shrug off shots getting blown in half or getting their entire like chest blown out and smoke billowing out. Seeing the dad robot die in a fist fight against his mortal enemy on top of a crumbling city of a building. Very different.
So what we're saying is Game of Thrones stole from Transformers.
Oh yeah, the Autobot Red Wedding is definitely Transformers the movie.
Everything stole from Transformers the movie.
It's the baseline.
It's not wrong though. Like for example, the War for Cybertron games and hell, most Transformers video games and some media all riff on Transformers the movie in some way, shape, or form. I mean, Optimus Prime has died like 400 million times. Jesus took it once. Prime's died like 40 times at this point. Not to be slightly blasphemous, but yeah. Easter's coming up seems to make sense.
Yeah. I mean, I think what's really interesting about Transformers, and really feel free to correct me on this one, Steve, but my gut feel is that Transformers the movie, and I should stress, I'm always talking about the 1986 movie.
Yes.
Actually is the baseline for what people think about when they think about Transformers and make adaptations of anything. I don't think they think about the original TV series.
It depends, generally speaking. Like 9 times out of 10, I want to say yes. But then there's outliers like Transformers Animated, which is obviously that little bit more Saturday morning cartoon of its era, early 2000s. And then you've got Earthspark, which is basically the same kind of vibe. Transformers Rescue Bots, you're definitely not having that in the same continuity as Transformers the movie. You know, for your under threes, I don't think they could handle Unicron somehow. But I mean, that's the whole kind of ones about micro continuities and different timelines and different comics and things. Beast Wars, I could be here all day talking about Transformers. Jim's very right.
All right, stick that down on a future or more. What's here talking about Transformers?
But no, I mean,
maybe we could do a tear death experience. What a commentary. We could do both of these things.
Which Transformers death was the most traumatic?
Oh, goodness.
Just rate
me.
The Autobots. 12-hour stream.
Rate the Autobots. And it's just like, you know, I hate this version of Bumblebee. I hate this version of Bumblebee. I hate this version of Bumblebee. Sorry. Yeah.
So what we're essentially saying, like, is just do what Transformers 986 did.
Kill all its cast off. Insert H.P. Lovecraft. Yeah.
And introduce glam rock to the universe.
Never hurts. Yeah. Never hurts. I think kids' TV shows and video games seem to be the easiest sell. Right?
Yeah.
Would we say that?
Because you're right. Because there's not much thinking, is there? Like, there's not much, you don't need to do much thinking, but if you want to put extra thinking in, I think that's the kind of a skill with writing, to be honest. If you want to put extra in, you can.
I think that's something that's changed over the time. Like, if you go back, like, you'd be astonished if you go back to watch some of the old sort of kids, Saturday morning kids TV shows from back in the day. How much more complex the characters are than they are in television programming now for kids. Characters like Starscream don't turn up now, for example. Yeah. Like, something like Ulysses 31 doesn't turn up now. That's right. Should do, but it doesn't. That's the unexplored kind of adaptation that no one's actually made yet. But I think you get so much more depth of storytelling and so much more depth of character. And whereas now I think storytelling is just much more dumbed down. I think it's just much more direct.
Everything has to be a multiverse and everything has to be meme-y.
Everything has to be like Chekhov guns to the absolute nth degree.
Yeah. There's other things to take into account as well. Like these days, I mean, I say these days, it's always been an element, but it was hidden before. I'll talk about, because the original question was about pitfalls, but I don't think people in this might be hyperbole, but I don't think folks with big companies who are just looking at that year to year, I don't think they can identify pitfalls. They can see them. They don't think they see the holes that are there. They just see the cash. With BG3, for instance, again, Sven said that they were working on a DLC. They were working on an expansion. They were going to continue adapting this. But then he said he looked at the room ahead of him and he saw faces drop. He saw the looks on people's faces. He could read it, and he read it as, this is 5 more years of doing this. And he could see that the passion had started to drain. He identified that. You know, if only kind of... I like Resident Evil 1, the movie. Like, I like Aliens Resurrection.
Risky venture, go on.
So... Resident Evil 1, the movie, is not Resident Evil, but it's a fun movie to watch. Alien Resurrection is not an Aliens movie, but it's a fun Aliens movie to watch.
Okay.
Right. I do not count them. Obviously, I do not count Alien Resurrection in the canon, and obviously the Resident Evil movies are in their own universe. Right. However, there was some structure in those first two movies, the Resi ones, and then they just went wild. It was like someone is like pulled up his hands and said, we're gonna make 7 of these, and I don't care, just gets the whip out and starts snapping it, you know. And they, you could see it, they were just slowly, as the movies went on, the structure was like disintegrating. I don't think they're good movies.
I mean, the first two films they have a through line, and then the second, the third one starts, the entire planet's been obliterated off screen.
Right. It's like, I mean, it's not like that hasn't been done in Resi before, but they were just disintegrated. Like, the creative process had just gone out the window. Like, casting was crap. The story writing was awful. And it wasn't great in 1 and 2, but at least it was salvageable in some way, like, for its own universe. And, like, you know, with Sven, they earned the credentials there. So they had the backing there to kind of to go, right, we don't want to do this anymore. We're going to focus on something else, something that we're more passionate about, and we're going to continue with that. And I completely respect that. And I think that should be done more. I think, even though I love Castlevania Nocturne, I really do love it, I saw some drops in quality. In that show. I love Nocturne. But I saw some drops in quality to that series than I did the first season of Castlevania.
Castlevania is a very strange one. Like, if you look at it on paper, they've taken only cribbing from the cliff notes of the first three games, mostly the third, and most things are aesthetically different. If anything, it's more referencing Symphony of the Night in terms of Alucard's outfit, Dracula's outfit. Trevor's his own unique one. It's more of an amalgam of every single Belmont ever. Cypher's from you know, aesthetically as close to the sprite as you can get, just give it red hair and the old NES sprite. But nothing really correlates. But it works because that's what it's cribbing from the entire mythology.
Mm-hmm.
Nocturne's almost its own like reinterpretation of the French Revolution with Castlevania elements around it. I personally like it, you know, but we're also we're in almost a unique fan fiction territory because Dracula is in a different place. He's not the returning bad guy anymore, so you have to come up with a new bad guy, and now you have to have a new threat. But you're going to have new existing characters come in, like Richter Belmont, who's been completely changed from how he was. He's now a cocky young kid who's lost his mother, as opposed to brash, arrogant vampire hunter trying to save his missus.
Mm-hmm.
Those rewrites, though, are what keep it interesting for me, which is an outlier, because most adaptions, if it does that, it can really change. I mean, we've already gone over Zelda, Mario, things like that. Dragon's Dogma, from what I understand, is that adaption was very, very piss poor. Dragon Age, same thing. Just its own like fan fiction. Sometimes it doesn't work. It's a frustrating how much you can throw the darts at the dartboard, and sometimes you have the perfect lineup, and it just doesn't work.
I think my point was that like Nocturne, I think might have been the start of a hole.
Yeah,
it might have been like I know I'll watch season 2, 3, and 4, and I'll enjoy them. But I wouldn't. It might be because of nostalgia, but I don't think I'll ever get the enjoyment that I did out of the original. Is it 4 seasons with the first Castlevania?
Yeah, but I think most people tend to say season 1 or 2 where you really even beat that.
Yeah. But yeah, that's all I had to say about it, because I just don't think some companies know how to identify it, or big heads know how to identify those problems. Instead, they'll see their team like not pulling their weight, and then they will crack the whip. Right, and say we need to meet these deadlines, you know, and then we get a substandard product that we wanted more.
I don't necessarily know that's necessarily true though of adaptations, yeah, uniquely.
Hmm. Oh yeah, yeah.
That's a larger thing, isn't it? When you get to corporations and companies and profits and all sorts.
Yeah, Yeah, you're right. It's just I suppose I could frame it by saying it needs to be different for creative endeavors.
Well,
like, because if you try and force something out of somebody or a team that is not in it, you know, then you're not going to get what you expect. You're not going to get something that could be beautiful or could be perfect or could be something that could live on.
Yeah. I think perhaps bring this back a touch to adaptations. I'm just trying to think of, and possibly this is possibly moving away from the pitfall. So I don't know if we want to carry on with that line first before we.
We can move on. We're going long anyway.
It's something where I was actually thinking fondly of two examples I can think of, where it's actually something that it goes away from the. From the original orbit and has fun exploring its own space within that. And there have actually been, as a result, two of the better adaptations I can remember. And the first is the Warriors video game, which is exceptional because it just takes the movie and doesn't try to recreate that in a grand sense. It does sort of slightly more adjacently, but really it's just exploring the gaps within. And I think that's really important to kind of flesh out that sense. And that's exactly what you're talking about. It's letting creatives be creative. Just saying, hey, look, here's the source. Here's the original. Here's what we were running with. Now let's flesh this out around this. Yeah, that's what we're steering for, rather than trying to recreate something that everyone knows as a story. And as a result, you get a lot coming out of it. And of course, the other one, which is the titan that we must acknowledge when we talk about adaptations, which is GoldenEye.
Yeah, no, it's fair.
I was talking about this only a couple of days ago, actually. Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, big. It's got big shoes to fill.
We're a long time down the road now from movie tie-in games, but the 90s was a Wild West era of quality, and you know, not necessarily always good, but GoldenEye is definitely one of them. I mean, obviously,
it's the
tentpole N64 shooter, regardless what anyone says otherwise. The shooter on N64, GoldenEye. You know, but then no one's talking about, oh yeah, the Mask platformer game on the Super Nintendo. I don't think that's anyone's favorite. Maybe Aladdin on the Mega Drive. Like, you know, generally speaking, bit of a mess, bit of a quagmire. I feel like movie tie-ins in terms of the other way around, that's definitely its own separate fucking thing. Sorry, I apologize.
Mark that down.
Yeah, definitely, it's its own wild kettle of fish.
Yeah, I mean, but then at the same time, you had things like the Street Masters. That's a whole different thing. The Street Fighters movie, for example, and that.
Now
that is its own thing entirely. Arguably, I think more fondly of that than I do the video game.
Yeah.
So
I remember when we did our podcast about it. We loved that. We loved that movie so much.
It should not be as enjoyable as it is. Well, okay. Yeah. It's terrible representing the game. But at the same token, I think it's Raul Julia and Van Damme just being those people. That's what everyone's saying. No one gives a damn about T-Hawk, Ryu. Just like, you know.
It's the Riz, as the kids say. You know.
Beauty Gat Rizzler, Ohio. But I beheld Satan as he fell from heaven like lightning. You know, yeah, no. Amazing.
Well, I mean, with that, like, because that's like, as you say, like, that's a different place. Like, we don't know why we love it so much, but we do.
We don't love it because it's an adaptation, though. We just love it because it's amazing. Yeah, that's funny.
But it is an adaptation. Kind of, you know, it adapts the games to a movie. Mm. So, like, what... we could go into our final kind of subject, which is how do we think these different mediums, like, offer new perspectives on all media, like how do adaptations help or change things, like you know, like I put in my notes that I think I might get shut down for this, but I feel like video games, board games, and then like the power of TV and TV shows, like those are two different things. Like, video games and board games is all about being interactive, mm-hmm. having the weight in your hand to carry the story. Whereas a TV show and a movie is all narratively driven. You have to, the weight is in the writing, and the weight needs to be put on the characters so you can feel the characters and the weight within the story of that. That can be interchanged. Like, we had that weird show on Netflix called Bandersnatch, which was, you remember that?
Yeah, and Black Mirror, yeah?
No, it was his own thing, I think.
Black Mirror
it?
Bandersnatch, where you can choose your own things. Making games. Yeah, I remember.
Yeah, and you could interact with it, and it was strange, but I kind of loved it. Like, it was new and strange, but they tried to do that, and it hasn't really gone anywhere since. But yeah, it was a unique way of telling a story anyway. Yeah, it's why, like, a lot of scenes on the silver screen, like, even if they're direct copies of the game, they don't hit as hard. You know, because you're not in control. You're not in control of that scene, so it doesn't hurt, it doesn't hit you, the weight isn't there as much. Even if something is a carbon copy of what you see on the screen. I'm trying to think of an example right now, but I put myself in the hot seat, so I can't.
To run slightly counter to that, James. Okay. We're talking about Street Fighter the movie, but just okay. The first Mortal Kombat film. Okay.
Yeah.
The fighting is more frenetic and energetic than the entirety of the games, generally speaking, of that era. Mortal Kombat 1-3, outside of the actual like fireballs and fatalities, it's kind of like jumping kick. You know, looks a bit wank, is what I'm saying. Whereas you look at the actual film and its music. You know, you can't beat a bit of 90s EDM and fist fighting. I'm sorry, you know, it sells it in a very different way than the game ever could. Depending on the situation, obviously. Like, for example, I'd imagine if they ever did an XCOM TV show, it's not like you're going to be watching it all from above and dudes going round corner, missing a shot point blank range. It'd be probably a bit more like The Wire or something, where there's intense gunfights and shrapnel going everywhere. Yeah. I see what you're saying, though. Like, you know, there is always going to be a narrative disconnect for how a player would experience it and how it would be portrayed in celluloid.
You can't just do direct adaptations. You can never do that.
No.
Like, you can't. It can never be done. Like, because they're completely different mediums. No. Like, but you can take other things into account. Like, that marry with the medium. You know, you just need to add weight, like, to all of these different adaptations. Because I never, there are a lot of, I'll watch an adaptation, or I'll play an adaptation, or, you know, whatever. And, but I'll never feel as connected as I did, you know, to when, even when I was playing the game, or when that masterpiece of the movie came out, or the TV show came out. I'll never feel that connection there, like, from bad adaptations. I think that's important.
I'm going to offer you a different perspective on that.
Yeah.
Which I think a lot of adaptations, if they're done well, are an opportunity for the fandom to explore that thing that they love in a different medium. Mm-hmm. And I think if done well, that effectively amplifies what it is that they love. It lets them tell their own story as part of it, for example, or to rewrite that kind of sense of, yeah, I'll use the Resident Evil board game as the example. One of the things I see the most out of people who like that game is that they love the fact that they get to save the Bravo team. Mm. It's in their hands. It's no longer scripted. It's the ability to say, oh, this thing happened and it was emergent narrative and it was amazing because it was super awesome that I got to interact with what the game was from a different perspective, to understand it as in a, this was my story, not the one that was prescribed to me by the video game or whatever that I've seen a whole bunch of times I've played through. It's that sense of... One of the things that's really interesting about Resident Evil, and perhaps this is a unique Resident Evil, but the first experience of playing a Resident Evil game is dramatically different to every other time you play Resident Evil. The first time you play it, you don't know where anything is, you're wandering around, you are scared, you are trying to find your way out of this situation, you're trying to survive, that's what you're doing. The moment you finish the game, you know where all the jump scares are, you know everything's going to happen, suddenly it switches into, I'm trying to smash my best time. And the whole game changes in terms of what it is. One of the reasons the Resident Evil board game is popular is because of, you know, people like it, is because every single time you play, it's the first time. Yes, you might know what all the levels look like, but you don't know what's going to happen or where you're going to find things in those levels. You don't know what enemies are going to turn up, where they do. You don't know what events are going to happen and so on. Every single one of these things is effectively that alternate reality retelling, or that alternate reality make it your story or make it your own. And I think that sense of ownership is really important. It's also a capacity for, and I'll go back to the Resident Evil board game as well, but could be any one of the different games you might have, I can now enjoy Resident Evil with my friends instead of just sitting in front of a screen on my own. And it's, and I think that's what a good adaptation should do, rather than being like something for people, a cash cow for someone to go milk, you know, Monster Hunter movies. It could be anything like,
agree.
Anything along those lines. It's something where instead it's about just really amplifying that thing for everybody who loves that, you know, loves that license, loves that IP. Mm. Like, you know, if you really, really like, you know, the Transformers TV show, guess what? Transformers movie is going to be amazing for you because you're really going to dive into it and enjoy it. You know, if you really like that stuff, you're going to really like the comics and graphic novels and everything else that came out of it, because all of that amplifies what the experience is, right?
Yeah.
I think that's a key thing to tie into, that if you do it well, that's what adaptation should provide.
Yeah, well said, actually. Like, that's a great way of putting whatever was in my head down. Like, I was... Because, yeah, I if you can put all those things into an adaptation and do it well, then you're going to have a success, aren't you? Like, if you can make... Like, if you are trying to adapt the board game, or you're trying to adapt a video game into something, and you add those elements, add the unpredictability, but also keeping the essence of whatever you're trying to create, it's important.
The reason we like the Resident Evil Street Fighter movie is because it's goofy, and because it is all over the show, but at the same time, it kind of feels like the video game in some way. Like, oh, well, that's not the Ryu I recognize, or that's a weird take on M. Bison or whatever else. But at the same time, does it kind of capture the same sense of what it is? It
feels comfy. Yeah.
Comfy.
Feels familiar.
Yeah.
It feels comfortable. It feels like something where we can talk about whether they captured the right essence of what M. Bison should be or whatever else. Like, and as far as we're concerned at that point, it kind of feels adjacent to that thing that we love, and it's a way of us exploring how much we all really liked Street Fighter. I think that's the key thing, isn't it? And that's where, when you have something that goes well off rails, like he talks about with Alien, for example, like Alien Resurrection, I'll be away from you. It's just a terrible movie. just, yeah, it's
But
and I think
I agree, it is. I need to but jump in. I can watch it with friends.
I need to jump in because adaption wise, one of the best survival horror games on PS1. Alien Resurrection.
Isn't that wild?
Survival horror game on PS1. Terrible movie.
It's so wild that that's the case.
To be fair, the Alien 3 video game on the SNES, I remember, was better than the Alien 3 movie.
Yeah.
It's again, these things can come out of nowhere and be that. And if I was an Alien fan, both of those games are really good examples of where I could enjoy Alien a lot more and go, actually, this is really cool. It's captured the same sense of what it is. It's awesome. Feels great. But I think that's the key thing. It's the same as if you look at Star Wars as a really good example. TIE Fighter, X-Wing, all of those games, they just really lean into that sense of, oh, it's amazing. I love Star Wars. I love the, you know, bombing about the TIE Fighter, shooting things, you know, shooting down the bad guys, that sort of stuff. Like, you know, it's kind of got that sense that just amplifies the awesomeness of that thing that you really like. Get to the prequel movies and that goes in the opposite direction. So, yeah, there's lots of stuff like that.
Well, there's nothing wrong with Star Wars politics, right?
Star Wars, it's a beautiful myriad of many things.
All right, anyone else got anything else to add?
To nutshell it,
it away, Steve.
I feel like passion for the project is integral, always. Like, made by committee stuff, you can tell it's made by committee, will always falter at the last hurdle. Sometimes it can get a second, a glow up in the future. For example, Street Fighter, Super Mario, like, they have found their audience through time. Not necessarily received well at the time. I think the main thing, passion for the project and less contempt for the established audience, for me. Like, you can do your own thing and it can be very successful. Just don't admonish what came before and have, like, just, you know, disdain for it. But there's still one adaption on the table that James hasn't talked about, and it's about his very favourite board game, and it's a cartoon TV show from the 1980s. Dungeons & Dragons. We'll talk about that another time after I've got James to watch it all the way through back to back. You know,
we don't need to do that.
But no. Yeah, the two points I want to hit on are, it could be one-to-one. It could be one-to-none. Just love and appreciation. That's all.
The soul there, right?
That's the main thing. Have a bit of soul and integrity about it.
Yeah. All right. Thank you to everybody here. Thank you for talking to me about adaptations. Let us know what you think in the comments about adaptations. Check out our Patreon. It's for exclusive first looks. And subscribe on our YouTube for more. Listen to our podcasts on all good podcasting sites. And we'll see you next time. Bye.